From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In February, after nearly 20 years as a U.S. diplomat, John Brady Kiesling resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Kiesling about how he made his decision, the personal and political repercussions, and his thoughts now that the war is over. You may have read his letter of resignation. It was published in newspapers and was circulated through the internet. At the time of his resignation, Kiesling was political counselor in the U.S. Embassy in Athens. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews American Life, the new CD by Madonna. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Central Command says U.S. forces in Iraq have taken custody of one of the best-known officials of Saddam Hussein's regime. Tariq Aziz, the former deputy prime minister, was number 43 on the U.S. list of 55 most wanted Iraqi officials. So far, there are no details available on whether Aziz was captured or turned himself in. U.S. officials say that at talks in Beijing this week, North Korean negotiators confirmed U.S. suspicions that the reclusive communist nation has nuclear weapons. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
According to one senior Bush administration official, the North Koreans announced that they had reprocessed spent fuel rods that could yield plutonium for nuclear bombs. The official, who asked not to be named, said a North Korean negotiator also pulled aside Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly and said Pyongyang has nuclear weapons, and whether it tests them depends on what the U.S. does. Asked whether any talks will continue, this official said, "What's the point?" Secretary of State Colin Powell, who has promoted a diplomatic solution to the crisis, said North Korea must understand that the U.S. won't give in to threats. As he put it, the North Koreans should not leave the Beijing meetings with the slightest impression that the U.S. will be intimidated by bellicose statements. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The retired American general in charge of post-war reconstruction in Iraq said today that a government rebuilding effort will begin next week. Jay Garner held talks with more than 50 academic and community leaders, then told reporters he plans to have Iraqis run government ministries. NPR's Ivan Watson reports Garner says the leaders won't be picked by the U.S.
He said that none of these individuals are candidates of the coalition. In fact, he said the American-led coalition does not have any candidate at all in Iraq, that it would be the Iraqis themselves who would begin choosing some kind of leaders, and that we would begin seeing some of these leaders next week, beginning with a process that he promised would begin next week to appoint a new democratic government for Iraq.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. The head of the pilots' union at American Airlines reportedly says the airline and his union have reached an agreement that could keep the troubled carrier from filing for bankruptcy. The Associated Press quotes the union president as saying the latest deal would change the pay cuts that union members approved last week. President John Dara told union members that the pilots' union board has approved the deal, but it's still awaiting approval by officials of the flight attendants and ground workers' unions. Union members were outraged last week when they learned of a plan to give top executives bonuses and guaranteed pension packages at the same time workers were accepting pay cuts. In stocks today, the Dow lost 75 points to close at 84.40. In heavy trading, the Nasdaq lost 9. This is NPR News. Northwest Airlines says federal public health officials have confirmed that a passenger aboard one of its domestic flights did not have severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. The Minneapolis-bound flight was delayed at San Francisco Airport while officials checked the passenger, who had exhibited some SARS-like symptoms. An airline spokesman said the flight, with 170 passengers aboard, was cleared to fly by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In Texas, an undercover agent involved in a controversial drug sting has been indicted for lying under oath. Janet Heimlich reports.
A grand jury in Swisher County near Amarillo has indicted Tom Coleman on 3 counts of aggravated perjury. The charges stem from testimony Coleman gave at an evidentiary hearing last month. It's the latest turn of events that cast doubt on one of the state's biggest drug busts. In 1999, Coleman led a drug operation that resulted in the arrest of 46 people. Most of the defendants were black, and Coleman, who's white, used no recording device when he made the arrests. 13 of those convicted remain in prison, but if an appellate court orders new trials for them, a special prosecutor has said the state will dismiss the cases. If Coleman himself is found guilty, he could face up to 10 years in prison and a $10,000 fine on each third-degree felony charge. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
The UN Security Council voted unanimously today to extend its oil for food program with Iraq. The vote extends the program until June 3rd and permits the UN to use Iraq's oil revenues to buy food, medicine, and other humanitarian supplies for the Iraqi people. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chuck Kistner and Carrie Orr Kistner for support of the NPR Endowment and recognizing the NPR President's Council, helping to ensure NPR's financial base.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After a long career as an American diplomat, John Brady Kiesling resigned in protest over U.S. policy in Iraq. He was based in the American Embassy in Athens when in late February he wrote a letter to Colin Powell saying, "The policies we are now asked to advance are incompatible not only with American values, but also with American interests. Our fervent pursuit of war with Iraq is driving us to squander the international legitimacy that has been America's most potent weapon of both offense and defense since the days of Woodrow Wilson. We have begun to dismantle the largest and most effective web of international relationships the world has ever known." You may have read his letter. It traveled around the world through the internet. We invited Kiesling to talk with us about why he decided to resign and the personal and political repercussions of that decision. We also invited one of his diplomatic counterparts who has supported the war in Iraq to talk with us, but the State Department declined to participate in our program. John Brady Kiesling served in diplomatic positions in Tel Aviv, Casablanca, Washington, D.C., and Armenia, as well as Athens. Let's start with an excerpt of his letter.
"Dear Mr. Secretary, I am writing you to submit my resignation from the Foreign Service of the United States and from my position as political counselor in U.S. Embassy Athens, effective March 7th. I do so with a heavy heart. The baggage of my upbringing included a felt obligation to give something back to my country. Service as a U.S. diplomat was a dream job. I was paid to understand foreign languages and cultures, to seek out diplomats, politicians, scholars, and journalists, and to persuade them that U.S. interests and theirs fundamentally coincided. My faith in my country and its values was the most powerful weapon in my diplomatic arsenal. It is inevitable that during 20 years with the State Department, I would become more sophisticated and cynical about the narrow and selfish bureaucratic motives that sometimes shaped our policies. Human nature is what it is, and I was rewarded and promoted for understanding human nature. But until this administration, it had been possible to believe that by upholding the policies of my president, I was also upholding the interests of the American people and the world. I believe it no longer."
John Brady Kiesling, now that the fighting in Iraq is over, do you still think the war was a mistake?
I'm afraid I do. I'm very pleased that the fighting ended quickly. I'm very pleased indeed at how few American casualties there were. I'm relatively relieved that the number of Iraqi civilian casualties was low. But this was not a military problem. This was a political problem, and the political problem is as bad or worse than I had expected.
In what way?
We have dismantled a very nasty dictatorship and made clear that we had absolutely nothing in mind, at least nothing realistic, to replace it with. We're now seeing the emergence of forces, you know, the Kurds in the north, the Shiites in the south. We ourselves have no legitimacy, no effective credibility with the bulk of the population there. We cannot persuade them to act in their own interests and get along. The structures that exist are mostly religious structures. They're fundamentalist. They're inherently hostile to or at least suspicious of the United States, we will find ourselves with a growing disaster. I can see now a tendency for the administration to say, oh, it's Iran's fault, and to make threatening noises there. But it's not Iran's fault. The Shiites have no source of legitimacy but their own religion and their own structures, and those structures are coming to the fore now in a way we will find frightening.
So what are some of the problems you think we have inherited?
One of the worst problems is that we now have a Kurdish community that's relatively well-organized, relatively well-disposed to the United States, rather divided internally, that is now in a mode of triumph and exultation. It's wonderful that they've rallied around General Gardner, and they love him as a liberator. That's fine. However, anything that makes the Kurds happy automatically will make everyone else in Iraq scared to death. They know that the Kurds want to have an independent state. They know that there will be an independent Kurdish state unless they all rally. They see the Kurds and the Americans in bed together, and their conclusion is not going to be a positive one as far as U.S. interests are concerned. There are many other problems we can talk about. We can talk about the general problem of the collapse of services, the fact that for the next year or so, the population of Iraq is going to be considerably worse off than it was under Saddam. To make the situation better than it was under Saddam will require spending money, American money, which the American taxpayer, though he implicitly made a commitment to spend it, the U.S. Congress is not going to make people do something difficult when the budget deficit is so huge elsewhere.
The process of deciding to actually resign must have been a difficult one. I'm sure there were plenty of times in the past and you had disagreements with the administration that you were representing. But in the scheme of things, you accept that you have differences. Would you describe a little bit about what that process was like for you of saying, this is it, I really can't go on? I mean, how hot did the water have to get before you were ready to, like, jump out of the pot?
Resignation is a very complicated process. There are very few people in the world who are pure enough to do anything purely for an ideal or an idea. I was, for reasons, you know, for personal reasons, somewhat disenchanted with the State Department. I saw that over time, you know, starting with the new administration of President Bush, the traditional role of the State Department was getting much less appetizing. The policies that we were being called to represent were policies that were basically ugly. We were telling the world America is too weak, too vulnerable to accept any kind of international law like the International Criminal Court. I mean, that kind of idea, the idea that even though in the past, we had believed the International Criminal Court was something that the world needed so the United States would not have to try war criminals. Rather, there would be, you know, a legitimate international body that would do the dirty work. And we knew this was in our interests. And then suddenly we lost our nerve and said, oh, my God, they'll drag Henry Kissinger away and throw him in jail. This was nonsense. But for populist reasons, the U.S. Congress, you know, passed the American Servicemen's Protective Act, which said, you know, no American person will ever be subject to the International Criminal Court. There is a vein of paranoia in American politics. It's a dangerous vein. It's usually kept under control. But this time I saw that vein of paranoia had risen to the fore. We had a president who was too weak and too uninformed to serve as a meaningful check on that. And so we were drifting into just a really unnecessarily bad foreign policy. And this made me angry. I saw the State Department, a bunch of people who are much more effective than I am at balancing their ideals with practical politics. They were being cut out by people totally ideological. And the trend was getting worse and worse. And then when I saw that the American president was willing to stand up and lie to the American people, or actually tell half-truths that were then interpreted by others as lies. I mean, it's
for example, about the role of Saddam with al-Qaeda on September 11th. You know, there was no role. We knew there was no role. But for political reasons, it was excellent. You know, it helped win the midterm election.
So you found yourself more and more in disagreement with the policies of the Bush administration and with the statements coming from leaders within the Bush administration. Was there anything in particular that you were asked to say or do that you felt you couldn't say or do?
I had loyally defended American policy on Iraq. I had gone through and made all of the arguments why the only way that we could disarm Saddam was by being ready to go to war if he did not disarm. It's a powerful argument. It's a true argument, even. I loyally called up old friends who said, old Greek friends who said stupid things about American policy, and I chewed them out, and I said, look, our policy on Iraq is about the security of the United States and the security of the world, and we're not going to do any of these bad things that you're saying. We have a reasonable policy. But then, you know, I did that over and over again. I could not persuade anyone in Greece. We could not persuade anyone in Europe. World opinion was overwhelmingly convinced that we were lying, which is a very bad thing to do. Lying to the world, you can get away with occasionally. You should not do it as a matter of practice, because when we have no credibility, then we have no legitimacy. Everything we try to do afterwards costs us much more and becomes much more difficult and dangerous. Anyway, so I came to the conclusion, as I saw what happened in the United Nations, that in fact the decision for war had been made months ago. I see that's been confirmed by the by Time magazine, that President Bush had made the decision as early as March of last year. But I felt that I had been used. I felt that the system was so badly undercutting America's long-term interests that I couldn't be part of it. And when you combine that with general disenchantment about how diplomacy has been marginalized, how we have been asked to do things that are essentially impossible. And then, of course, I see now that Newt Gingrich is blaming the State Department for having failed to do something that, A, we knew was impossible, B, we didn't really agree with, but C, we loyally tried because the President of the United States told us to. And it didn't work, and it didn't work not because we didn't try, but because it was impossible. And now Gingrich is trying to rewrite history and damage Secretary Powell, who's a very competent and decent person, even if I don't always agree with his policies.
My guest is John Brady Keesling, a career diplomat who resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Brady Keesling. He was the political counselor in the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He served in several U.S. embassies before his most recent position in Athens. He resigned in protest, effective in early March, in protest over the impending war in Iraq. Did you talk with Secretary Colin Powell before resigning, and did you express your concern to him about U.S. policies, about the war in Iraq, and about the difficulty you were having representing those policies?
I should have. I'm not certain what would have happened if I, as a senior mid-level Foreign Service officer, had asked for a meeting with the secretary. I suspect I would have been given a meeting either with the assistant secretary or possibly with Undersecretary Grossman. But No, I didn't. I spent a lot of time in September drafting something called a dissent channel message, laying out my views that our coming war with Iraq would really hurt our interests. I never sent it because the State Department was not the decision maker in this. We had already been rolled by the Defense Department and some of the ideologues in the White House. Secretary Powell was not the problem. He unfortunately could not be part of the solution either. And so I just I decided, you know, there's no point in burdening them with it. They know the problems in the State Department. They agree with some of them. They don't agree with others. It wouldn't make any useful difference.
You mentioned that you were going to send this dissent channel message. Yeah. Is that a kind of formal way that a diplomat is supposed to express their disagreement to the Secretary of State?
Exactly. It's a wonderful system. It's been in place since the Vietnam War. Anyone in the State Department can write a message or draft a memo or send a letter and just write at the top, dissent channel. That message will automatically go to the Secretary's office. It must be answered. The writer cannot be punished in any way for having given his advice. It's a mechanism that isn't used very often, but every once in a while it's been used effectively. And the fact that we have it speaks very well of the State Department for encouraging this kind of, you know, unconventional thinking. We don't always use it, but at least we try.
So the letter of resignation was really the first that the State Department knew of your...
That's true. I told my ambassador the day before I sent the letter. I showed him the letter before I sent it. He was in an awkward position because he couldn't really comment on the content of the letter. I mean, he's a loyal representative of the President of the United States, and as the ambassador, he has no flexibility on this. He can report privately back to the State Department that things are going badly, but publicly and even to his staff, he has to maintain a strong facade of loyalty.
So what was the reaction within the State Department and the Bush administration in general?
I don't know about the Bush administration. The State Department, to its credit, took the high road. And they said, we regret that Mr. Kiesling chose this. We regret that he resigned. We don't agree with his views, but we respect his right to make those views public. A lot of my colleagues came up to me and expressed their full agreement with my letter, expressed their dismay at the way our policy was going, or even some... Actually, there were all nuances, because the State Department is, in fact, itself divided. There are people who firmly support the war with Iraq, a smaller number, but a handful who think that it's a good idea to bypass the United Nations. But most people were sort of ambivalent about the war, but knew that we were unnecessarily harming our interests by damaging the NATO alliance, by weakening the United Nations, by alienating European and Middle Eastern and Asian public opinion, and by generally telling the world that international law doesn't apply to us. Anyway, so I had a lot of support, a lot of friendly emails, and then I heard from people I hadn't heard from in years, a huge amount of respect for, at least for my moral courage in doing what I did, and that felt good. That was a real help to me.
Was it a very difficult letter to write? And I don't mean the act of writing a dissenting statement, but rather word for word, finding the right phrases to express the depth of your feeling.
Normally, I'm a medium-fast writer, but I tend to play with words a lot. This letter came out of me much faster and more easily than I expected. I wrote it one night. I came back the next day because I realized, I wrote something that's very cold and foreign policy oriented. And in fact, I need to put myself into this to say, here is an American who believes in America, who thinks that America has ideals, who believes that America's ideals are fantastic, who thinks America's the greatest country in the world, who suddenly sees himself and his colleagues and his country being asked to behave as if we're a bunch of frightened, defensive, surly, dare I say, bullies. I mean, in the international world, when we have such a position of strength and dominance that we don't have to behave badly. We have the luxury of behaving well, and even behaving well serves our interests. But no, you know, this was, for me, a source of anger and anguish that we have a choice to do good. We as the United States have power, we have money, we have leisure, we even have good intentions. There is no limit to the good that we can do in the world if we try, if we believe in ourselves, if we live up to our own ideals, but and we're not.
Your letter of resignation was spread around the internet. People were emailing it to each other. Did you expect that to happen? And do you have any idea how it did happen? Like, who started it?
I don't know. I did not expect this to happen. It was, for me, gratifying. The one thing I worry a little bit about is, you know, all of the response I saw was very positive. But there is another internet community. There's sort of the liberal idealistic internet community, and then there's the tough-minded, you know, America First internet community, and they don't overlap at many points. But I saw that somehow what I wrote had reached out not just within the United States, but around the world. I think my text has been translated into, you know, probably dozens of languages now. I've gotten emails from bizarre parts of the world. And speaking to the idea, you know, the message I've gotten from the rest of the world outside the United States is, thank God we were losing faith in America. We had always seen America as a place that actually believed in things, even if they didn't always behave well. And, you know, you've confirmed that there still is this good America, this America of vision and idealism. And in a way, it's pretty frightening when I personally am elevated to this pedestal of being someone speaking for the good America. Obviously, there are, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of good Americans who, offered a chance, would speak for the good America. Unfortunately, they're not visible publicly right now, or many of them.
It sounds like you also got a lot of, that you read a lot of negative things about your letter on the internet. Were there websites that were insulting you and attacking you?
Actually, fewer than I expected. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about a well-written letter is it tends to shut up the opposition pretty well. The comments, the negative comments, were mostly not attempts to argue point by point with what I said or believed, but simply, well, good riddance. We're glad you're not a diplomat anymore. And that's fine. I mean, I'm glad I'm not a diplomat anymore if being a diplomat means having to speak for an uglier America than the America I think we really should be.
John Brady Keesling was a career diplomat. He resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. At the time, he was the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Harcourt, publisher of Big If by Mark Costello, a novel about what happens when the FBI, a campaigning vice president, computer war game programmers, and the American way of life collide. Available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with former U.S. diplomat John Brady Keesling. He resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. In 1994, he shared an American Foreign Service Award for constructive dissent for criticizing U.S. inaction in Bosnia. Also, Ken Tucker reviews American Life, Madonna's new CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former U.S. diplomat John Brady Kiesling. In February, he resigned in protest over the pursuit of war with Iraq. Kiesling was the political counselor in the U.S. Embassy in Athens and also served in embassies in Tel Aviv, Casablanca, and Armenia. His resignation wasn't the first time he expressed a dissenting opinion. No, I've read that you thought we should have intervened sooner in Bosnia to stop the ethnic cleansing there. And you protested that by being one of a small group of people who signed a memo in 1994 protesting the U.S. failure to stop the killing of the Bosnians by the Serbs. And did you think that that protest resonated, that it was it effective in getting the Clinton administration to change its policy?
That protest was a little different in that our problem was mostly that we didn't really have a policy. We were drifting along. President Clinton was not enthusiastic about getting us involved in foreign adventures. It was a messy issue, but a lot of people in the State Department were convinced that if the United States and a few of its European allies, under any kind of international rubric at all, if we just sort of stepped out and said, no more to the Serbs, we could stop the violence. And that's what we pushed for, and we actually succeeded temporarily. It was a model of how you can work within the system when you have an administration that's open-minded enough to take advice.
You were actually given an award for constructive dissent in 1994 from the American Foreign Service Association. It's an interesting concept for an award, one that's totally unfamiliar to me, an award for constructive dissent. What kind of award is that, and what did it mean to you to get that?
The award was given to the dozen of us who protested the policy in Bosnia and got that policy to change. It's an excellent award. It's our colleagues, as sort of the diplomatic trade union, saying, look, you've been willing to stand up and challenge the received wisdom and make a difference, and you should be praised for it. The terrifying thing about bureaucratics is that people tend to hunker down, go with the groupthink, and you can get yourself into catastrophic situations if there's nobody willing to stand up and say, excuse me, the emperor has no clothes. The Foreign Service says it wants that. The Secretary of State is absolutely clear that he wants to hear dissenting views, but very few mid-level bureaucrats really believe in their heart of hearts that this is true. And, it takes a certain amount of courage, but usually that courage is rewarded and not punished.
Bosnia was a profound experience for a lot of people who had formerly thought of themselves as being primarily anti-war, because in Bosnia and in Kosovo, they felt that, the United States needed to use force to intervene to stop the slaughter. And so some of the people who supported the war in Iraq were supporting it because of this lesson that they felt they learned from Bosnia and from Kosovo, that sometimes the United States has to intercede with force. You are obviously not in that group of people, although you felt strongly that the United States should use force in Bosnia and Kosovo. You didn't think force was appropriate for Iraq. Would you talk about that a little bit?
It's a matter of the scale of the thing. We used force in Bosnia and Kosovo to achieve very specific goals, to stop the slaughter of innocent people. We did not have major goals of redrawing the map of the Balkans. We were trying to go back to an old status quo. That wasn't quite possible, but at least we had a limited aim. We used limited force to achieve it, and there were existing structures to take over. In the case of Iraq, there's not the urgent problem of lots of innocent people being slaughtered. Saddam has murdered, tens of thousands of people, no question. He wasn't actually slaughtering them right now. We were going to go in, remove his regime, and build up something from scratch. This is a huge job. You could argue that it's worth it if you're willing to pay the cost and recognize how high the cost is. My argument was always that the cost was too high for the United States. We had no legitimacy to do it. No one in Iraq really likes us except some of the Kurds. They don't believe in us. The world doesn't think we have what it takes to do it. I've tried to do democracy building in other countries. It's hard. you seldom get the results you want. We have messed up Iraq really badly. I mean, and I knew that the scale of the enterprise was so vast that it was totally incomparable with the narrow humanitarian intervention that we undertook in Kosovo.
You've said that you worked to build democracy in other places that you were posted in, and you know some of the difficulties that one faces in trying to do that. Where are some of the places that you tried to build democracies, and how does that apply to what we're trying to do in Iraq?
As the Romania desk officer, I spent a lot of time working with USAID and the U.S. Congress and others interested in weaning Romania from its communist past. It was a fascinating job. The problem is, after the communism fell, a bunch of old parties, new parties, business elites, oligarchs, you know, all tried to divide up the spoils. We were working as best we could on building, you know, what's called civil society, a network of parties, groups, and just sort of faith in human institutions to make the country work. We did not have much success. Romania has turned the corner because it's now has the option of joining the European Union, and the European Union says that you've got to be really democratic, and the Romanians are pulling up their socks and trying very hard. And, you know, here's an example of how the European Union, because it has this old-fashioned American vision of human progress, of democracy, of ideals, is actually helping democratize Eastern Europe, whereas our influence was not all that great. I then went to Armenia. I spent 2 years there working very closely with politicians, with local groups, with the democracy building. We had made a little progress, but by and large, the country is still dominated by these, you know, rich oligarchs, we don't have a good solution, despite all the money we spent, despite really good intentions, despite a lot of work. And that's a country that's pretty small, it's pretty homogeneous, it has a lot of good ties to the United States, and we haven't made much of an impact. In Iraq, a huge country, vastly divided, religiously polarized, it's going to be much more hard and much more difficult, and we have no clue how to do it.
My guest is John Brady Keesling, a career diplomat who resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Brady Keesling, and in early March, he resigned from his diplomatic position at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He resigned in protest over the then-pending war in Iraq. I'd like to ask you to read another paragraph from that letter of resignation, and this is a paragraph that's about the Secretary of State, Colin Powell.
Mr. Secretary, I have enormous respect for your character and ability. You have preserved more international credibility for us than our policy deserves and salvaged something positive from the excesses of an ideological and self-serving administration. But your loyalty to the president goes too far. We are straining beyond its limits, an international system we built with such toil and treasure, a web of laws, treaties, organizations, and shares values that sets limits on our foes far more effectively than it ever constrained America's ability to defend its interests.
You know, in reading that line, your loyalty to the president goes too far. Is that something that you think would have been perceived as insubordination, which I suppose is irrelevant when you're leaving the position anyways? But that's a pretty potent thing to say to the Secretary of State.
I agonized over that line. I don't know whether I thought that he should himself resign or whether that he should stay and fight the good fight. On balance, I think he should stay and fight the good fight. Because he has international credibility, he has credibility with the American people, he's got to use it to resist the trend of toward isolationism, toward sort of unilateralism.
Do you feel like he's, quote, fighting the good fight, or do you feel like he now actually supports the policy that you're hoping he would object to?
I'm disappointed, frankly. I believe that he's moderated our policy, but not enough really to do any good in terms of saving our lost honor.
You were a diplomat for how many years? About 20 years?
Just under 20 years.
Do you feel in those years that you served as a diplomat that you saw attitudes toward America change?
I've seen American attitudes toward the United States go up and down. During the Cold War, I saw the end of the Cold War, and during the Cold War, there was a general feeling that Americans were kind of tough and, well, Americans were a necessary evil. Then there was a post-Cold War period when it seemed, you know, when things were getting better, we seemed to be pretty good. President Clinton enjoyed a lot of admiration, at least in Europe, as someone who had real sort of humane values, who was doing his best to work with the international community to make the world a better place. The real crash came with the past year, basically. Attitudes toward the United States, which in Europe used to be, say, 70% positive, 30% negative, have crashed down to, you know, 70, 80% negative, 5% positive. And this is terrible. We and the Europeans share so much. I mean, all our values are in common. And if they think we've gone sort of off the reservation, it's sad and it's unnecessary.
As a diplomat, do you share any of the Bush administration's criticisms of the United Nations, that the United Nations is a bureaucracy, that it often slows things down, that it's ineffective, that people representing tyrants have important votes in the United Nations? Do you share any of those concerns, or do you mourn the disarray now in the United Nations?
The United Nations has always been slow and bureaucratic and somewhat expensive, but that said, usually in foreign affairs, the best thing to do is not very much. The United Nations has been a great force for slowing down people from doing stupid things, for giving international legitimacy to good things that need to happen on a global scale. It's not wonderfully effective, but over time, you know, it's had bad periods and good periods. We've pressed hard and effectively for internal reforms, and 80% of the time, the UN is a really good organization to have in our corner. And the 20% of the time when it's resolutely opposed to us, it's probably not a bad idea for us to ask, okay, why does the whole rest of the world disagree with us? Is there any logic to their position? And unfortunately, sometimes there is. So definitely, despite all of its weaknesses, we need the United Nations. We should work to strengthen it, not to weaken it.
You're in an interesting position now. In the 20 years that you served in diplomatic positions around the world, you were known within the international community, but you weren't a public figure outside of that, I don't think. Certainly not in the United States.
Certainly not. I'm just a minor cog in a vast American foreign policy apparatus.
But now you're a lot better known as a result of that letter of resignation, which traveled around the world through email and through, I suppose, websites on the Internet. And you've been making speeches now. You've been written up in newspapers. So it puts you in a different position because suddenly you're more of a public figure, more of a public spokesperson, and you're at the center of controversy as opposed to diplomacy.
That's true, and it takes a very different way of handling myself, and I'm still learning. You know, I haven't figured out what my real role should be. I fear that by speaking out too openly, I will lose my credibility with with key people in the foreign policy establishment. At the same time, and there's enough frustration that every once in a while I can't keep it bottled up. There used to be an alliance of realism and idealism in foreign policy. We have to go back to that. I would like to help the the sort of the traditional foreign policy players reestablish some control of the game and take it away from the ideologues.
Do you have any second thoughts about resigning?
Not about resigning. I have a lot of second thoughts about how best to have used my resignation to do good. I have a lot of second and third and fourth thoughts about what to do next with my life. But the actual resignation seems to be the one decision in my life I've taken where I'm absolutely convinced it was right.
So what are you thinking about doing next? And have you been getting a lot of job offers and suggestions?
Not job offers so much. I've a lot of suggestions, a lot of sympathetic interest. There are people who would like me to write a book. I'm seriously thinking of that. I'd like to become an academic, I think. I like working with students. My guess is that I'll do some more writing over the next few months, see if I can turn that into at least a temporary position at a university, and try to retread myself as a more disciplined academic thinker and less as a sort of disheartened American diplomat.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to your audience.
John Brady Keesling was a career diplomat who served as the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. He resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. We tried to also speak with one of his diplomatic counterparts who supported the war, but the State Department declined to participate in our program. Lyricist Felice Bryant died on Tuesday at the age of 77. Her name isn't nearly as well known as her songs. With her late husband, Budlow Bryant, she wrote the Everly Brothers hits Bye Bye Love and Wake Up Little Susie and the bluegrass standard Rocky Top. Here's the Everly Brothers, recorded in 1957.
I think I'm gonna cry. Bye bye, love. Bye bye, sweet caress. Hello, emptiness. I feel like I could die. Bye bye, my love. Goodbye. There goes my baby with someone new. She sure looks happy. I sure am blue. Was my baby till he stepped in. Goodbye to romance that might have been. Bye bye, love. Bye bye, happiness. Hello, loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry. Bye bye, love. I feel like I could die. Bye bye, my love. Goodbye. I'm through with romance.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's new CD, American Life. This is Fresh Air. Madonna pulled the video for the title song of her new album, American Life, because it contained anti-war images, and she said she did not want to offend anyone who might misinterpret the video. A Madonna who doesn't want to offend? Ken Tucker has this review.
Do I have to change my name? Will it get me far? Should I lose some weight? Am I gonna be a star?
Thank you. I tried to be a mess. I tried to be the best. I guess I did it wrong. It's why I wrote this song. This type of modern life, is it for me? This type of modern life, is it for free?
As self-created a star and musician as pop music has produced, Madonna's career depends on her constantly reinserting herself into the culture at precisely the right moment to be maximally effective. Thus, releasing an album called American Life, complete with a first single that critiques the indulgence of stardom, and a video emphasizing Army Fatigue Green would seem to prove her granite ab gut instincts to be as infallible as ever. But then listen to this rapping inserted into the middle of the title song.
I do yoga and Pilates and the room is full of hotties, so I'm checking out the bodies and you know I'm satisfied. I'm digging on the outside, poke this metaphysics is dope, and if all this can give me hope, you know I'm satisfied. I got a lawyer and a manager, an agent and a chef, three nannies, an assistant and a driver and a jet, a trainer and a butler and a bodyguard of five, a gardener and a stylist. Do you think I'm satisfied? I'd like to express my extreme point of view. I'm not a Christian and I'm not a Jew. I'm just living out the American dream, and I just realized that nothing is what it seems.
The times, they are a-changing too fast even for a woman married to a jump-cut junkie like director Guy Ritchie. And so the clipped rap that commands the most attention in the middle of the title song, a yammered list of celeb perks, trainer, butler, assistant, three nannies, a bodyguard or five, seems at first not like the clever self-parody she clearly intended, but rather a facile confirmation of her critics' most knee-jerk conviction, that middle-aged Madonna doesn't have a worldview beyond her next Pilates appointment. However, if you listen a bit more closely, you'll hear songs that are unironic arguments for substance over style, family over isolation, long-term love over flighty romance. She's also found a musical corollary for such fulsome sentiments, a mixture of acoustic and techno.
There are too many questions. There is not one solution. There is no resurrection. There is so much confusion.
And the love profusion, you make me feel, you make me know. And the love vibration, you make me feel, you make it shine.
There are too many options.
That song, called Love Profusion, is one of many romantic ballads on American Life, attesting to a newfound serenity. These can be gloppy, but at least once, on the terrific Nobody Knows Me, she makes wonderful music out of meditation and maturity.
I've had so many lives since I was a child, and I've realized how many times I've died. I'm not that kind of guy. Sometimes I feel shy. I think I can fly closer to the sky. No one's telling you how to live your life, but it's a setup until you're fed up. This world is not so kind. People trap your mind. It's so hard to find someone to admire.
I don't think this album is going to dent mass pop consciousness in any appreciable way. And of course, mass penetration is an absolute fundament of Madonnaology. Which is to say, this album fails to do what this brand of pop music must now do, provide future American Idol contestants fresh anthems to belt out with mindless enthusiasm. Which should count in her favor, shouldn't it? I mean, here's something to chew on, Madonna haters. She's become beside the point in part because she's meditated, exercised, and exorcised herself into the thoughtful, humble, well, okay, striving to be humble, star/musician you never thought she had it in her to be. Oh, and as for that video that she pulled, I think its retraction had little to do with fear of being the latest chick to be Dixie Fried. Come on, unlike blindsided, otherwise mannerly country acts, Madonna thrives on, indeed plots her controversies. No, it had more to do with the fact that current events imposed an interpretation on its images that this meticulous performance artist did not intend. It's true, war in Iraq has altered the context of her new music in a way that's not always flattering. But since when did Madonna ever crave flattery?
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed American Life by Madonna. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Einstein in Berlin, a biography of Einstein's years in Germany from 1914 to 1932 by Thomas Levinson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely.
Willie Nelson celebrates his 70th birthday next week. On the next Fresh Air, we get a head start on the celebration and feature an interview and performance with him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I knew